Oh, I see a pointing of the signal, and the blue light is on, so. Good morning, everyone. I want to call and order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you very, very much for everyone being here. This is our first day to be meeting during the, is this the 79th? Legislative Assembly session. So I want to thank everyone for being here today. We're going to be just really kind of doing our organizational meeting, as well as we have a possible work session in the sense of introducing some committee measures. We'll also will be entering into the area of informational meetings, and this is really for our colleagues who have not been here. What we're trying to do is get us as much overview of the different agencies and departments and commissions or whoever else we might have come before us. And today we're flattered and honored to have the Oregon Judicial Department that will be providing us an overview of how the courts work and how the courts work with the legislative branch, being two of the three branches of government. We'll also will have a public hearing and I assume a work session on the bill of Senate Bill 489. With that, I'm going to go ahead and open up an organizational meeting. And the purpose of this is to do the introduction of our committee members, our staff, as well as adoption of rules. So I think what we should probably do first is do the rules and just get that done. And then at that point, we'll go ahead and go through the others. So, Senator Thatcher, I think we're on the green sheet.
Oh, green sheet.
From what I saw scripted here.
Okay. Thank goodness they scripted.
Absolutely.
Sure. Okay. I move we adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 1st, 2017.
All right. Senator Vice Chair Thatcher moves that we adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 1, 2017. Before we ask for discussion from members, Chana, why don't you give us a little overview about what we have on those rules?
Certainly, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. We have 18 rules on the Senate committee rules this year. First off, no quorum needed to take public testimony, but you do need a quorum for a work session. These rules can be amended with one day's written notice and a majority vote. The role of the chair is to set the agenda and to run the committee, and all meetings are open to the public. An interesting change from years prior is that you may specifically allow electronic testimony. So if we wanted to bring somebody in on Skype or another digital media, we'd now have the explicit authority to do that. Rule 4 deals with carrying items over onto another agenda. The measure must have been properly scheduled in the first place, must be carried to the same type of meeting. It must be announced on the record that it will be carried over by the chair, and the revised agenda must be posted as soon as possible. And if a measure is carried over due to a lack of fiscal or revenue statements, it can be scheduled for the next regular meeting. The chair can designate subcommittees to take public testimony. So again, back to rule one, you don't need a quorum to have public testimony. Let's see, votes are needed to introduce measures, amend measures, send measures to the floor, make recommendations, or to table a measure. A majority of the members can force a hearing if proper notice is given to the chair and the secretary of Senate. That's rule eight. Rule nine, we don't need any seconds in this committee. 10, all meetings and actions are recorded. 11, if applicable, committee measures will reflect who asked for them. 12, 13, and 14 deal with minority reports. Very briefly, the rules are that two or more members must have been present and voted in opposition to the committee report, which is generally the final action on a measure. Notification must be made to the chair or the analyst by 5 p.m. on the day of final action, or before adjournment of the committee, whichever is later. The LC draft and the report are due back to staff by 5 p.m. on the second business day following notice of the minority report. Rule 13 deals with the notice once the one-hour notice requirement has been invoked. It's a little different, more compressed timelines. We'll go over that again as we get closer. Let's see. You can only sign on to one minority report per measure, but it's possible to have multiple minority reports on a particular measure. You have to have voted in opposition to the final action in order to sign on to the minority report. Amendments must be on OLIS for at least 1 hour before we can take action upon them. Non-member proposed amendments must be submitted to staff within 24 hours of the hearing that they're going to be considered at. We must have a fiscal and revenue statement to move a measure out of committee. And if we move something out of committee that has a small clerical error, the chair can correct that with his signature without recalling it to the committee to fix.
All right, so those are the rules, and basically what we, the rules that Chana has gone over for us are the boilerplate rules that should be pretty much unified across all of the committees for the Senate committees that we have. So any discussion regarding what the proposed rules are for adoption? Not seeing any. Is there any objection to the motion that we have to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 1, 2017? Not seeing any, so ordered, and we now have rules to operate under. The one thing, I guess, for clarification, just for the record, I think when we're going through rule number 15, it says that for a non-member proposed amendments, they need to be to us at least 24 hours in advance. I just want to make sure that was clear because I think I heard within, that it's really 24 hours or greater. So with that, we're going to take just a small opportunity to allow our members. We have new members here today, and it's going to be part of the Judiciary Committee. And so at this point, I'm going to ask each of the members to introduce themselves, and then we'll also have our staff introductions. And I think what I'm going to actually do is start with the staff. And the reason for that is because we know without a good staff, we're not going to be able to get our work done. So, Chana, if you would like to take the lead for the introduction of the staff.
Certainly. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm Chana Newell. I've been working in judiciary since 2014, and I started here in the legislature in 2011 working with the redistricting committees. We have an excellent team of counsel and assistants this year. We have Josh Nasby is sitting over there now. And Josh most recently came to us from the Judicial Department, but did a lot of excellent work in legislative council and with committees in prior sessions. Whitney Perez is with us. She worked with us in the 16th session, and prior to that was at the Marion County Public Defender's Office. We have Michael Lance. He is our intern from the University of Oregon School of Law. And then staff, we have Mike Riley. He's our office coordinator. Mike will be your first go-to person if you have any committee questions. Christy Arrington, committee assistant. Lisa Rybloom, committee assistant. And Lindsay Free, who will be working in mostly the House Judiciary Committees, but you'll see her from time to time in here as well.
All right, well, thank you for the staff. Thank you very much for, one, being part of our family and helping us and directing us, because we all know that without your assistance, we cannot get our work done. So thank you very much. So I'm going to go ahead and start with the members, and we have kind of a seniority type of thing, and so I've tried to give a heads up so no one will get caught off guard. But I understand, if I have this correct, the individual member that we have with the least seniority in the legislature is our good Senator Dennis Lithencombe. From Cave Falls, and I will just make that clear that only about 14 days or 16 days in minority compared to our next member, which is James Manning. So, Dennis, if you'd like to tell us a little about yourself.
Very good. Thank you for the introduction, Mr. Chair. My name is Dennis Lithencombe. I am from Klamath County, former commissioner in Klamath County. My wife and I basically live an hour outside of the city of Klamath Falls. And so this is the big city for us, and it's great fun to be here, and I thank you for the kind welcome.
Thank you. And Senator Manning.
Thank you, Chair, and commissioners. My name is James Manning. Trying to get off to a good start this morning. This is really exciting for me to, and an honor for me to be here. I represent Senate District 7, which is Eugene and Junction City. Former EWEB commissioner, that's the Eugene Water and Electric Board, worked on a lot of things as dealing with green energy and renewable energy sources. Former police officer, 24 years in the United States Army. And thank you again. I'm honored. One thing, if I may, we just recently had suffered a loss, and I know it's not the appropriate time, but I do have to mention Dr. Coleman, who was a University of Oregon a professor for some time with a very steep history in social justice past, and we had a going home ceremony for him yesterday that was well attended by a lot of Eugenians and people from around the world. So I just wanted to kind of put that in there. It's not the appropriate time, but I think that it providing recognition is appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you. And so welcoming back a member to Judiciary that kind of wandered away, but we got him back, Senator Dimbrough. So, Michael, why don't you tell us a little bit, refresher for us.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Michael Dimbrough. I'm the senator for District 23. That's northeast, southeast Portland, Maywood Park, Park Rose. And I have been in the legislature since the 2009 session. I was in the House. I moved over to the Senate in the fall of 2013 to fill an appointment, to fill a vacancy left by our good friend Senator Dingfelder, and I inherited all of her assignments as well as all sorts of tough issues. she was generous, and I remind her of what she left me with all the time. We're driving down together tomorrow. She has a hearing down here that she'll be part of, and I will continue to remind her. I was really very fortunate to be on this committee in 2013-2014. Got to work with Chair Przanski and Shannon Newell, and it was a delight. I learned an awful lot, probably forgot most of it, but I'm eager to relearn all the intricacies of the judicial system. And, you know, just to remind my newer members or let you know what a privilege it is for me to be on this committee as a non-lawyer. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a cop. I'm just an ordinary person, but it's a privilege and a really important assignment, so thank you.
All right. And my vice chair and colleague, Senator Kim Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kim Thatcher. I represent Senate District 13, lucky number 13. It starts at the south part of, working my way from north to south, south part of Hillsborough, down through Shoals Valley, rural areas of Washington County, into Sherwood, Wilsonville, and down to Newburgh, St. Paul, and Kaiser at the south end, which is where I live. And I'm not a cop, not a lawyer, but I did work at the Clackamas County Courthouse in high school. So I am clearly qualified here. So just saying. No, I really, really enjoy being on this committee, and I'm glad I could be back.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. So I'm Floyd Przanski. I'm a state senator out of District 4. District 4 includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. I've had the opportunity to serve in the legislature basically since 1995 with a sabbatical of 2 years because of term limits. So did 7 years in the House, just completed 13 here in the Senate. I've been blessed and fortunate to be able to serve on the Judiciary Committee of all of my sessions that I've been here. I'm honored to be asked to continue to be the chair. I do have legal background. In fact, I'm probably, if I remember correctly, the only practicing attorney in the Senate out of the 30 of us. Two others, I believe, are legally trained, President Courtney and Senator Johnson. So it's always one of those opportunities for the perspective of bringing many different people from different parts of the state, as well as different philosophies and backgrounds. And that's one of the things I think that really makes our committee so vital, because it does, in fact, bring different perspectives to the table when we are asked to look at many different issues, some of them very complex, to have the perspective of all. So with that, I'm very pleased, and thank you very much for all of you volunteering. I know the president had the final word, but I'm glad that you all are willing and able to be here, and we'll have a very good session. And if there's anything that we can do to assist all of the new members, please let us know. And if we're assisting too much, let us know that too. All right. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the organizational meeting. I'm going to open up a work session. This is for the possible introduction of committee measures. And Senator Thatcher.
Okay. Chair Brzozinski, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. And there's a list. Stay tuned. 3381, dated January 5th, 2017. LCs 3382, 3383, 3384, 3385, 3386, all dated January 4th, 2017. LC number 3387 and 3388, dated January 26th, 2017. And LCs 3389, 3390, dated January 4th, 2014. Excuse me, how would I get that? Amend that. Okay. January 4th, 2017.
Excellent.
All right. And LCs 3391, 3392, 3393, 3394, 339, oops, we'll stop there, all dated January 27th, 2017. And LC 3396, dated January 30th, 2017. And LCs 3397 and 3398, dated January 11th, 2017. And 3399, 3401, dated January 25th, 2017. LC 3403, 3404, we'll stop there. January 27th, 2017, the dates for those LCs. LC 3406, dated January 25th, 2017. LC 3408, dated January 26th, 2017. LC 3409, dated January 25th, 2017. And LC 3410 and 3411, dated January 26th, 2017. LC 3443, dated January 25th, 2017, LC 3444, dated January 26th, 2017, and the last one, LC 3445, dated January 27th, 2017.
Thank you. Senator Vice Chair Thatcher has moved to introduce the LCs that she's put on the record. As committee bills. Before we take that motion and vote on it, I do want to give a statement for all. These are LCs. These are basically being introduced as legislative concepts. It does not mean that any of us will be supporting whatever the merits of the concepts are at the time, if they are actually brought before us for any type of hearings or any type of vote. This is just a process that allows us to get bills before the legislature. My understanding in speaking to Chana, the vast majority of these are known as placeholder bills, and these are ones that we're basically we'll use if and we need to, if we have certain matters come up that we need to address and the issues are fit within our relating clauses, we're able to take one of these and actually use that as the base bill for whatever the new concept might be. So with that, let me ask if there's any questions or discussions on the motion that's before us.
No.
Okay. Not seeing any, I'll go ahead and call the question. Is there anyone who is opposed to the motion by Vice Chair Thatcher to adopt the LCs that are on record as committee bills? Not seeing any, so ordered, and they're now in part of the system. We'll go ahead and close the work session on possible introduction of committee measures. We're going to go ahead and open up our informational meeting. And Chana, why don't you first start off with giving us an overview?
Certainly, Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee. Today we have with us the Oregon Judicial Department and two justices from the Oregon Supreme Court who are going to come here and tell us about their branch of government and how we can interact with them and what we need to know about the Judicial Department.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and ask if the two justices, Justice Kistler and Landau, if y'all will please come forward. And I think, Bruce, you're coming up too? Okay, and Bruce Miller, for those who have not seen the sheet, Bruce is the senior staff counsel for the state court administrator within the Judicial Department. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much for taking time out of your busy day to give us an opportunity to hear as to the perspective of how the Judicial Department works and how we interrelate our work together. And I'll let you go forward as to however you want to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior counsel to the State Court Administrator. For those who are not of you who are not familiar with us, Kingsley Click is the State Court Administrator. She is responsible for statewide administration and day-to-day operations of the Oregon Judicial Department. When I appear before you, I appear on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department. Thank you for inviting us to give an overview of what we do. I'd like to take a moment to introduce our presenters. To my immediate right is the Honorable Jack L. Landau. To my far right is the Honorable Reeves Kistler, both justices on the Oregon Supreme Court. Justice Kistler joined the court in 2003. He attended law school at the Georgetown Law Center and graduated summa cum laude in 1981. He began his legal career as a law clerk for the Honorable Charles Clark, Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, and as law clerk for the Honorable Louis F. Powell, Jr. of the United States Supreme Court. He became a litigation associate at the Stoll Reeves Law Firm in Portland, and in 1987, he joined the Oregon Department of Justice as an assistant attorney general representing the state in civil and criminal appeals at both the state and federal level. In 1999, he joined the Court of Appeals, the Oregon Court of Appeals, as a judge and served there until he went to the Supreme Court. He's taught constitutional law as an adjunct professor at the Northwestern School of Law at Lewis and Clark College. He's a former member and vice chair of the Oregon Board of Bar Examiners and a former member of the National Association of Attorneys General. Justice Landau joined the Oregon Supreme Court in 2011. He graduated from Northwestern Law School at Lewis and Clark College in 1980 and then began his legal career as a law clerk for the Honorable Robert C. Baloney of the United States District Court for the District of Oregon. He then moved on as an associate and a partner in the Portland law firm Lindsay Hart Neal & Wagler. In 1989, he joined the Oregon Department of Justice as an assistant attorney general and attorney in charge of the Special Litigation Unit. From 1991 to 1993, he served as the deputy attorney general in the Department of Justice. He joined the Court of Appeals as a judge in 1993 and served there until he joined the Supreme Court. I think disdaining free time and sleep along the way, he earned his LLM, Master's of Law, Master of Laws from the University of Virginia School of Law in 2001. Since 1993, he served as an adjunct professor at Willamette University College of Law, teaching legislation, and he has written numerous articles for law reviews and publications. As you can see, we as a state are very fortunate to have justices of such high caliber. In that vein, I think it's important to mention that we have many men and women serving on the bench at both the trial and appellate levels with comparably strong credentials and experience. And with that, I'll hand it over to Justice Landau.
Thank you, Bruce, for that very generous introduction. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us to speak with you this morning. I understand our charge is to provide an overview of the judicial branch, who we are, what we do, how we interact with other branches, and so forth. What I'm going to do is begin with a bit of a historical introduction about how we got to where we are and what we do, and then my friend and colleague, Justice Kistler, will follow up. But we'll be pleased if you interrupt us with questions along the way. We're here to help you understand the relationship between our branches and what we do. I do teach legislation, and I'm not aware of other legislatures who do this kind of thing, and I just think it's really terrific that there is the kind of interbranch conversation that we've been having over the years. I think it's really constructive.
Justice Landau, just for the record, I need you to place your name on the record,
please. My name is Jack Landau, Associate Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court.
Thank you.
Thank you. The role of our court and our system of government is a little understood. Unfortunately, I've heard on more than one occasion that the three branches of government consist of the House, the Senate, and the governor. I gave a tour to a bunch of middle school kids once at the school, and one of the kids says, "So, are you a real judge?" And I said, "Yes, I'm a real judge." He said, "Yeah, what channel are you on?" So we, you know, we're very sensitive to the fact that we are the most anonymous branch, and so we're here to try to remedy that to the extent we can. The fact is that the courts are the third branch, the third stool of a three-legged stool. I mean, the third leg, and if you don't have all three legs, the stool will not stand. Without that third leg, government simply will not work. It is the courts that provide the mechanism for everyone, individuals, businesses, local governments, even state government itself, to resolve disputes peaceably, fairly, and in accordance with the rule of law. The importance of our court system dates back very far into the founding of our state. In fact, there was a court before there was a state of Oregon, back in 1841, 20 years before there was even a state. A pioneer by the name of Ewing Young died without a will. And unfortunately, he owned most of what is now the Chehalem Valley. And so you can imagine the folks in the area wanted to know who owned that land after he died intestate. And so the folks met at Shampui, and they talked about creating a provisional government. They ended up postponing creating a provisional government, but they did create a supreme judge, a court clerk, a sheriff, and two constables to resolve that very important dispute. Some years later, in 1857, when the Constitutional Convention met here in Salem, the framers did agree on a form of government for our state. They agreed on the creation of a Supreme Court. Actually, if you look at the handwritten version of our Constitution, they created a Supreme Court, spelling not being quite the matter of rigor as it is now. The Supreme Court consisted of four judges, and you might ask yourself, why four? Why wouldn't you have an appellate court with three so that you can avoid ties? And the idea was this. The framers wanted to have the judges do, in effect, double duty. They were very fiscally conscious back then, and they divided the state into four districts and assigned each of those four judges a district. Within that district, each judge would ride circuit and conduct trials. Then if any of the litigants wanted to appeal a decision from one of those judges, you would appeal to the Supreme Court, which consisted of the other three. So each judge was a trial judge, and each judge was a Supreme Court judge at the same time. Hmm. As the state grew, so did the demands of the courts. And so in 1878, the legislature did away with this kind of two-for-one judicial system and separated out a separate system for the circuit judges that would be assigned to each county and a separate Supreme Court. The important thing to remember about that is that the circuit judges were employees of each individual county. They were housed in county courthouses that were built and paid for by the counties. They were assisted by county employees and paid out of county funds. The Supreme Court remained an institution of the state government and paid out of the state's general fund. Over the course of the 20th century, the legislature increased the size of the Supreme Court from 3 to 5 and eventually to 7, which it is now. In 1961, it created a separate state tax court, which exists to this day. The tax court decides all matters related to state taxation, and then appeals are taken directly from the state tax court to the Supreme Court. In 1969, the Supreme Court found itself awash in appeals, partly because of expansion of the population, partly because of a series of 1960s United States Supreme Court cases that dramatically expanded the rights of criminal litigants. And the legislature responded by creating an intermediate court of appeals. So now we have a three-tiered system. trial courts in each of the counties doing the trials, an intermediate court of appeals sitting in panels of three to hear appeals from those trial courts, and then a Supreme Court with discretionary review of the decisions of the Court of Appeals. In the 1980s, the legislature decided that although the three-tiered system was working quite well, the management of the court system wasn't working so well. In particular, the legislature was concerned about the fact that the circuit courts were being paid out of county funds and the appellate courts were paid out of state funds, and that led to significant disparities from county to county as to funding of court operations. And so in 1983, the legislature created what is known now as a unified court system, so that all of the personnel in our judicial system are now state employees. That said, the buildings remained buildings owned by the counties, and so you have that kind of anomalous situation. That's historically how we got where we are to this day. Let's briefly talk about how each of those three tiers of the court system work today. In the first tier, you have the circuit courts. There are 173 circuit court judges in 27 districts throughout the state. Some of the counties have been consolidated into single districts. That's why they don't add up to the total number of counties throughout the state. The circuit courts are known as courts of general jurisdiction, which means they hear just about every kind of case imaginable. Criminal, civil, domestic relations, small claims, juvenile delinquency, foreclosures, debt collections, landlord, tenant, you name it, the circuit courts hear it. Their workload is breathtaking. Every year, the circuit courts of Oregon in total receive somewhere in the neighborhood of 600,000 filings, which means over the last 10 years, they've gone through about 6 million cases. The largest share of that workload is criminal cases, which, depending on the county or the district, is roughly 30% to 40% of the caseload. The second tier, as I've said, is the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals consists of 13 judges. Those 13 judges sit in four panels of three each, and then the odd judge is the chief judge, who acts as the administrator for the court and its staff. They're a court of general jurisdiction, of mandatory jurisdiction. They don't have any choice about the appeals. They get anything that comes to them from the trial courts all over the state. In addition, they hear appeals from administrative agencies, from all the agencies, boards, and commissions throughout the state. The 13 judges hear somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 cases a year. They're one of the busiest intermediate courts of appeals in the entire country, and the judges issue somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 written opinions every year. The parties who lose at the Supreme Court can petition, the Court of Appeals can petition the Supreme Court, because we are a court of what's called discretionary jurisdiction. We get to choose from those petitions which cases we're going to hear. We tend to pick the cases that are of greatest significance to most of the citizens of Oregon. We get somewhere between 800 and 1,000 of those petitions, and then we pick about somewhere 7% to 10% of those cases every year. In addition, the legislature has assigned to us non-discretionary responsibility for reviewing other categories of cases. Tax court cases come directly to us. Death penalty cases come directly to us. Attorney discipline cases, ballot title cases, prison citing cases, and a number of others. And on top of that, the court stands ready at any given time to hear cases that come to the court by special writs and emergency petitions. Collectively, we're called the Oregon Judicial Department. It's a separate branch of government, and sometimes it gets confusing because there's also this entity out there called the Department of Justice. The confusion results from an historical anomaly that way back in the 1800s, branches of government were called departments of government. And so for 150 years, we've just been known as the Judicial Department. But we're very distinct from the DOJ. We are the judicial branch, the state's court system. The DOJ is an executive branch agency that is headed by a statewide elected official, the Attorney General. It includes the attorneys who represent the state in litigation and provide agencies, boards, and commissions with ongoing legal advice and a number of other programs such as child support enforcement and so forth. But they're completely separate entities, completely separate branches of government.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Reeves Kessler. I'm Associate Justice on the court along with Justice Landau. I'd like to join him in thanking you for having us here. It is always a pleasure to be here and to talk to you and to look at your work. We're very thankful and lucky to have as good and responsible legislature as we have in Oregon, so thank you. What I want to do today is talk about a relatively simple point. Justice Landau sort of laid out the background. My point is more limited, and that is that the judiciary plays a limited role in our tripartite system of government. Our role, in my view, and I believe the view of my colleagues, is not to make policy. Our job is to apply the policy found elsewhere, either in statutes or in the Constitution, and to apply that policy neutrally and equally to everyone who comes in front of us. Most of what we do involves interpretation of statutes. And in that job, you are the people who make the choices about what our policy should be within constitutional limits. Our job is basically to understand what that policy is. And we do that. And Justice Landau will teach one course or two courses, or maybe three courses at length about all the ways you can interpret what statutes mean. But essentially, we look at the words you use, we look at the background out of which the law came and the legislative history, and out of that, we try to understand what it was the legislature wanted. That is our guiding principle, because when you look at the statute, all you're trying to do is to figure out what it is the legislature wanted to do and how it's going to apply in this particular instance. That's not always easy for maybe a couple of reasons, one of which is that words are imperfect mediums. You can't always find the words to express the principle. Even when everyone agrees on the principle, finding the way to express it perfectly is something that eludes almost all of us. The second problem, I think, sometimes is that you don't always foresee. No one foresees all the problems that are going to arise, and you could never imagine the different situations that will come up where someone will make a claim under a statute, and you have to figure out, given a statute or a provision that doesn't necessarily envision or hadn't thought about this problem, what do you do with this problem? One of the examples the Court of Appeals dealt with recently is the public meetings law. How does the public meetings law apply? Does it apply to seriatim communications upon the members of the quorum? And if you look at the two opinions in the Court of Appeals, they each had very good reasons for why they thought the law should be interpreted differently. It's not something that is clear from the history or the words of that statute. What I think that gives us the opportunity to do, the Court of Appeals tried to the best of its ability, and we did to the best of our ability, to understand what the legislature wanted. But if we get it wrong, or if you believe that the policy should be different, there's a dialogue, I think, between both the courts and the legislature to say, okay, no, that's not what we meant. You may not have understood us. Here's how we want, and it's, again, our goal is simply to do what it is the legislature wants to do. The other sort of large piece of what we do involves the Constitution, and now, I know you all know this, but I'm going to be a little bit repetitive or tell you stuff you already know, but essentially there are two constitutions, and I'm going to flip the order in which we usually talk about them. First is the federal Constitution, and it sets the minimum rights and limits that must be respected. That is, it's you cannot do less than what the federal Constitution requires. There is also the state Constitution, which is unique to Oregon, which is interpreted by our court, and we have the last word on that. But essentially, it can't effectively, you can't do less than what the federal constitution requires, but the state constitution can give greater rights or place greater limits than the federal constitution does. In interpreting the state constitution, we do much, it's similar in many respects to statutes. We are trying to find the policy in the constitution. We look to the text, we look to the history. The difference, I suspect, lies primarily in the fact that certainly the original provisions in the constitution are often phrased broadly. They may be written in 1857, and the federal constitution they're written back in the 1700s. And you're trying to figure out what the animating principles are in that document and how they apply to the problems that exist today. But that's our job. Our job, again, is not to decide whether we like the policy that's expressed in law or what the executive has done. Our job is to figure out whether or not that policy is consistent with and can be reconciled with the federal constitution. And that really is, so we are, you know, I believe we're an important branch of the government in the sense that we are a place where litigants can resort to have their rights respected. But the source of those rights is initially in the legislature and then also in the constitutions. So we're happy to answer any questions you may have.
So, colleagues, this is an opportunity for us to ask justices. You normally don't get to ask the judges questions. So if there are questions that you'd like to ask, on topic or maybe off topic, we'll see if they'll respond. Senator Manning.
Thank you first for being here. I really do appreciate the education overview. And just wondering, you know, you teach the course over at Willamette. So as I enjoy, you know, getting more information about the legislative process and stuff, and to have a Supreme Court justice to teach that. Are those courses available to just laypersons such as myself, or do you have to go into the degree program?
I think you'd have to talk to the Mr. Chair, Representative, or Senator Manning. I think you'd have to talk to the administration of Willamette and Lewis and Clark, where I teach this course. I don't know what the arrangements are.
Senator Manning, I would suspect if a senator asked if he or she could sit in on a course, they would probably say yes.
They might let you hot on it. And if you would ever like to be a guest in either of my courses, I'd be delighted to have you come talk to my students. I think that would be really terrific.
Well, I would appreciate the opportunity just to come in and sit in on your course. I mean, I think that it would help me a lot, you know, understanding what the expectations of your students are comparable to what we're actually doing, if there is a comparison, or maybe just help me get more insight as to understanding more about what your, you know, words are very important, as you indicated. And I think that that is a very critical part of this. And so, yeah, if I can get on your course schedule, you know, I certainly would.
Well, actually, Senator Manning, we'll see how many classes you attend. Yeah. Yeah. I'd say, I've got as much as I need to know already.
my course is Tuesdays and Thursdays at noon, if you're interested.
I guess that's going to let me out there. Yeah. I don't think I can make those.
Let's see what you have to ask the president on that one.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions?
Senator
Dimbrough.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. So driving down here this morning, of course, the radio is filled with the discussion of the appointee proposal to the U.S. Supreme Court. So, I think we're all going to be thinking about the role of Supreme Courts. One big difference between our court and that court is that you all are elected justices, whereas they're appointed for life. Elected judicial system, is that's typical of the states, isn't it? And has that always been the case? And could you say something about what flows from that difference?
Senator Dimbrough, I think it has been typical. Oregon has always had a long history of electing their officials, and I think that's something that we hold on to. It strikes me, because the governor gets the appointment for judges, and there's no political check in the sense of Senate confirmation in Oregon. The vote serves in some form as a check on that. I think we've been fortunate in Oregon in that the votes for judges have not become politicized as they have in some states. I don't know if we're living in a bubble, and I don't know how long that bubble will last, but we've been very lucky in that respect. I suspect that, you know, there's a debate about one of the reasons why you appoint federal judges for life is to insulate them from political pressure. At least in my experience, all the judges in the state operate without a view to political pressure, because our job is to follow the law. Our job is not to sort of gauge the shifting winds and figure out which way we should jump. And so although we don't have that protection that's available to the federal government, I believe all of us do our jobs to the best of our ability without regard to the sorts of pressures that might come up on difficult decisions. And there are difficult decisions, because, you know, they're decisions that may not – a lot of the times what we do is not easily understood by the populace. They see sort of the newspaper headlines without realizing that the law that we're following may compel a result that we personally wouldn't agree with. But our job as judges is to follow that law. So I think that – at least for us, we try, I believe, to ensure neutrality, and in the feds it plays out, because it's a huge stakes decision. It becomes a political issue in the confirmation process.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Dembro, you're right. Our system is pretty much in keeping with what most states do. Nearly 40 states have some sort of judicial elections process. There are some states that will elect their judges on a partisan basis. There are some states that will have the governor make the initial appointment, and then every so many years a judge will run for what's called retention. There's no opponent. The voters just say yes or no about whether they will retain the judge for another term. Most of the states are like Oregon, in which every 4, 6, 8 years you run, and if somebody wants to run against you, they will. And then there are a handful of states in which there is an appointment, and the appointment can be for life or for just a term without any elections.
Senator Thatcher, I think you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have two questions. One, I'll just throw them both out there and you can think about the answers, but one has to do with your class on legislation. And I'm very curious, I'm sure you make criticisms of the legislative branch, because we all do, you can't be helped. What would you like to see change here at the legislature? My other question has to do with the Oregon Supreme, or not the Supreme Court, has to do with the Oregon Constitution. So you look at our federal constitution, you see the whole history, even amendments that were deleted. I mean, they're there, but they're not in force. You know, I guess there's only one. But how come we don't do that in Oregon? I think it would be very interesting to see what our whole history is, because I think there's initially, when the Oregon Constitution was written, there was some pretty awful stuff in it, I would say. And for historic sake, it just seems like it would be good to have the whole thing. Okay, this is what was in place at this time. It is no longer. And then these things were added. It's kind of a messy constitution, as I understand. But it just seems like that would be, is there a place, a repository of the whole entire, additions, deletions, changes to the Oregon Constitution?
Well, you know, Mr. Chair and Senator Thatcher, you're going to catch me a little bit off guard. I think there may be. And I know that certainly you can find the original constitution with the pieces that I think all of us feel very bad about. Some of those didn't get repealed in 1926. Mm-hmm. There are, but I think they may still be in the Constitution. If you look at them, you just see the amendment later repealing them. So those are available. I'm trying to remember, there's like a history of Carey's history, which basically puts the Constitution together and also includes all the different changes to the Constitution, I think.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, in reference to your first question, about legislation and a critique of legislation, I've been teaching this for some 25 years, and in my experience, Oregon, the product that comes out of this process, the Oregon legislative process, is among the cleanest the best in the country. It's pretty remarkable how well-crafted Oregon legislation really is, given the limited number of days that you have, given the limited staff. You've got a terrific legislative counsel's office. You've got terrific committee counsel. And it is pretty remarkable. I saw a book that just came out. Brian Garner is a scholar of legal writing and drafting, and it's about legislative drafting. And it's a book that's filled with examples of how not to draft statutes. And there's only one example in the entire 300-page book that comes from Oregon, because he says, you know, Oregon stuff is actually pretty good. If I did have, and sometimes over the course of the years, I've actually had a brown bag lunch with legislative counsel, and we kind of informally say, what are things that we in the courts do that drive you crazy as legislative drafters? Mm-hmm. And then I'll tell you, what are some of the drafting things that you do that drive judges crazy? And number one on our list is always to make sure that whatever it is you're trying to accomplish gets in the words of the statute. That's what we have to work with. You can have all kinds of stuff in the legislative history, in the committee hearings, in the work sessions that you'd like us to consider in interpreting the words, but unless the words are actually there in the bill, we've got nothing to work with. So if I have one thing to suggest, and this is something that occasionally I've come and talked to committees about, statutory construction, and that's always my pitch, is the most important thing is that we're limited in what we can do by rules. And there's actually a rule in Chapter 174 that the legislature has given us, which says we cannot take anything away from the statute, we can't add anything to the statute, we have to work with the words that are actually there.
Senator Dimbrough.
I want to follow up on that. You know, there's sometimes in our bills we include whereases or findings or things like that, and there's kind of mixed opinion as to the usefulness of those. From your perspective, do you find those useful in terms of articulating legislative intent?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dimbrough, the answer is yes. Anything and everything that you can offer us in the way of articulating what's the problem that you're trying to address and why you think this statute is the answer to that problem helps us interpret the words in a way that best effectuates those policies. So if you have statements of findings, whereas clauses, preambles, whatever you want to call them, we'll always take those into account.
But Mr. Chair and Senator Dimbrough, I take it that you can't, if I understand from Justice Landau's comment, you can't use the whereas to substitute for an operative provision in the bill, so that the whereas can explain the words that are going to tell people what to do and what their rights and obligations are, but they can't independently supply them. So you have to make sure that if you're wanting to achieve a particular result, the bill tells people to do something or not to do something in the operative terms.
Other questions? So I had a couple, I guess, just points on what Senator Thatcher brought forward. If you're interested as a history buff wanting to see the Oregon Constitution, the archives building does have all of the copies of the Constitution. Our current one, I just wanted to grab it. If you'll look in our volume 17 at the back is where both the Oregon Constitution and the U.S. Constitution is printed. And it is interesting how it's kind of a mix here, because there is the amended Article 7, mm-hmm. which is the judicial branch, and then right following it is the original. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure why we have that in that sense, and so I thought that might be a good question to start off with as to why we would pull that and or still have that in the current draft or body that we have.
Mr. Chair, as I understand it, and my friend and colleague Justice Kistler can correct me if I'm wrong, is that when the voters approved Article 7 amended, amendment didn't include a repeal of the old Article 7. And so it's kind of a drafting fluke, And so we always include both of them in the printed versions of the Constitution.
Okay. So that's something that maybe, Bruce, we need to be looking at as to sending out to the voters, since we can't do that one. The other thing, I know that we're going to have a special breakout or another informational hearing on legislative intent, and that will give us a little bit more clarity as to how and some of the stuff that justices have shared with us today. But if you, I don't know if anyone wants just a really quick overview, or should we wait on that? Is that getting? We're going to wait on that. And then the other thing I would point out is that it is interesting, because a lot of times we in the legislative branch think we're very clear as to what we meant. The interpretation of the court is saying, well, wait a second, these words mean this, and how they have reached that interpretation. What it brings to us, and we have a number of issues every long session now, the regular lengthy session, where there have been decisions made by the court, and proponents or opponents to whatever that decision may be are coming to us and asking us to change the law to fit what they felt was the intent of the original law that was interpreted a different way. So we'll call out to you as we're going through this session, because I know of at least two areas that we have bills that have been introduced that will be addressing how the court had ruled. And that may not necessarily be the interpretation per se. It's just the actual ruling isn't what some people think it should be. So that's the other redress, I guess, there is based on what the court does. Sometimes we see a proposed legislation for us to consider something different. Any other questions, or Senator Manning?
Mr. Chair, thank you so much. Just wondering, you know, after listening to all of these things, you know, while I'm not a lawyer, I have played one, you know, in theater and stuff at the time. And my studies and stuff, you know, some of the things that I've done, you know, Criminal Justice Administration, you know, did some limited briefings and things, and there are some laws that, and for example, in New York, I was made aware that there's a law that you can't eat peanuts and walk backwards through Central Park. I don't know what the relevance was that, but they said it's still on the books, and, you know, you can be found in violation of that. Well, what I'm trying to come up with, are there laws here currently that we're looking at that you feel that are no longer relevant and should be removed or amended or simply done away to streamline process to help you better perform your duties, and it's something that we can get involved with?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Manning, first, we tend to not take a position on policy matters, and that might fall into the policy area. You will hear from us when something affects how courts operate, and we tend to talk to you about that. We appreciate questions from you about what effect will this bill have on the courts and court operation. If you were to criminalize manila envelopes, we would not weigh in on that. That would be a policy choice for you. The Legislative Assembly a few sessions ago started a process to identify obsolete statutes and repeal them. And there have been a few bills on that, and I think I saw one this session to repeal obsolete tax statutes. So I think that's the mechanism for the Assembly to deal with the issue that you raise.
In fact, this may be somewhat of a segue for our next portion after we get through the informational meeting. Let me just see if there's any other questions that we have for the justices. Again, gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward. And Bruce, why don't you just stay there, because I think we're going to keep you here. And y'all are more than free to stay and enjoy the rest of the meeting. But I assume you probably have other tasks to take care of.
Thank you very much.
So with that, we're going to go ahead and close the informational hearing, and we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 489. Chana, if you'll give us an overview, please.
Certainly, Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, as we've just heard about the Judicial Department's system and the work they do, they have brought us a bill that helps them clean up their statutes that deal with record keeping and file management. Over the last several years, they've moved into electronic file management systems, and there are some holdover statutes here that just don't make a lot of sense. This bill is ready to go today. There's no fiscal impact, no revenue impact, no amendments.
All right, and we have Bruce Miller still here, and then Lisa Norris, your last. Hi.
Norris Lampe.
Lamb Beach, okay.
And I'm the appellate legal counsel for the Oregon Supreme Court.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for being here. So I'll turn the table over to you two, and you can present as you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior counsel to the state court administrator. Lisa Norris Lampe is with me today in case I get in trouble and need someone to help me answer questions, because she helped work on some of the things that are in this bill. Last summer, we completed a many-year-long process of implementing the Oregon eCourt program in circuit courts across the entire state. During that process, we studied statutes to identify those that we could update to work better in an electronic environment. The goal of this bill is to make non-substantive changes to a variety of statutes so that they are more compatible with electronic court operations. The changes are in three main areas: remedial contempt, transfer of documents, which is the bulk of the bill, that's why it's so long, and residential forcible entry and detainer, commonly known as FED. Under the current statutory scheme, to bring to seek remedial contempt sanctions, you need to file a motion in the related proceeding if one exists. So for instance, if you have a family law case where support is owed and it's felt that contempt is needed to move that along, the statute requires to file that motion for contempt in the existing family law case. The problem we have is that the e-court system that we purchased doesn't allow that to happen. So we would like to change the statute so that we can match up with what the system allows us to do. We've developed a workaround on this internally, but we need to set it up so that the parties know how this is going to work. Our solution to this is to require that a motion be filed in accordance with the rules adopted by the Oregon Supreme Court. The court has rulemaking authority for contempt already under ORS 33-145, and in the Uniform Trial Court rules, we have Chapter 19 that has rules on contempt. So if this bill were to pass, that's where we would address this problem. This change will allow the court to implement a rule that meets our technological challenges and also to make adjustments as those challenges change, because the Oregon eCourt program is under constant development and change, and we may come to a technological resolution for this in the future. Sections 3 through 25 deal with transfer of court documents. It addresses a variety of statutes where one circuit court is required to copy and transfer a paper copy of the court file. That's no longer necessary because under the eCourt program, all circuit courts have electronic access to all of those court files, so there's just no reason to do it. The bill removes the copy and transfer requirement and replaces it with a notice requirement. So if one court becomes an auxiliary court in a family law case or a juvenile case, then they give notice to the other courts so that everyone knows who's on board. The bill addresses this issue for auxiliary courts in family law cases, change of venue or transfer cases in a variety of case types, judgment enforcement, and the filing of reports in fitness to proceed cases. That particular one, there's a provision in the statute that the hospital must file the report in paper and triplicate. Well, there's really no reason for that in an electronic system. Lastly, the statutory scheme for FED requires a landlord to serve a true copy of the summons. That worked really well in the paper world because a landlord would take her filings down to the court, have a face-to-face discussion with the clerk, and would walk out with a photocopy of the summons that the landlord could then serve on the tenant. Doesn't work that way in the electronic world. The interactions are not simultaneous and they are not face-to-face. So if I'm a landlord, I can file my action Saturday night while watching the Blazers play. The court won't process that till the next court day, probably Monday morning, and then exchange information with the landlord on the hearing time, date, and place. So under this system, under the filing system, the electronic system, you have the landlord filling out their version of the summons, which may look a little different from the court's version of the summons, and they may have different fonts and other small differences like that, even though the information is the same. So our proposed solution to this is simply remove the true copy provision, which would then allow these minor variations to occur. As some of you or all of you may know, the Oregon Law Center is very active in tenants' rights and in FED. I ran this provision past them, and they said they have no objection to it. So those are the three items that are covered by this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And are there any questions for our panel?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about the last point. So our handwritten summons or person-to-person summons no longer going to be occurring? Are they no longer occurring?
Those can still occur. We would like to encourage people to use the e-filing system. We require the attorneys in the state to use the system. We do not require citizens to use the system. So this will work best for landlords who have representation and their lawyers can do it, or a landlord that has a lot of properties and uses the system. But for the, you know, for the smaller landlords who are uncomfortable with the system or whatever, they can still go down to the courthouse and do it exactly the way they've always done it.
Senator Prezansky.
Senator Osicombe.
With regard to this last point, filling out one of these summons by hand, does that get I'm thinking about the true copy language that you're using. Does that get transcribed, or does it become a electronic photocopy PDF in the system, et cetera, or is there some sort of transcription? Possible mistakes occur in that vein, et cetera. So I'm wondering about streamlining that to get an electronic copy, or does it actually just stay in its original handwritten form?
Mr. Chair, Senator Linthicum, the way we envision this is the landlord sits at home with his summons. The court clerk has their summons. The court clerk is the one who identifies the information for time, place, and date of the appearance. Transmits that to the landlord. The landlord asks for it. Landlord puts that into the landlord's form. So the information should be the same, but it will look a little bit differently. Now, if the landlord were to put the wrong information in and the tenant showed up at the wrong time, the tenant then has a defense that this isn't the proper summons. I came when the landlord told me and I shouldn't be penalized because the court clerk had the proper information.
Okay.
And just for clarification, just to make sure I was following that, if a person, a landlord, does submit something through the e-system on Saturday night and then on Monday morning the court reviews it, I'm assuming whatever they have submitted through the electronic system is going to be part of that record in the sense of what they've actually submitted on Saturday night. They may get information back saying fill in your form with this date, time, and place. But there still would be the copy of what they had actually presented to the court as part of the whole file to the court. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct, because remember, the landlord has to file an action. That will get filed with the court. That's part of the record. Now the landlord has to serve the action on the tenant, and that's where the summons comes into play.
Right, and that's the other part, is that if you have someone that's not using the electronic system, they will still go down to the courthouse, go through the same process. They'll get the paperwork from the clerk to then serve on the individual. As under the electronic system, they get the information from the court electronically, they fill it out, and then they have the forms that they're going to then be serving. And each way, whoever is on the receiving end will in fact be receiving some type of documentation as to their requirement to be in court.
Right. And Mr. Chair, to get to what I think the concern here is, the complaint that's filed by the landlord, that doesn't change. That goes into the e-system. That's filed with the court, and that is what the landlord will serve on the tenant. So the wording in that complaint is going to be the same in both places.
All right. Any other questions from the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing, and I'll go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 489. Senator Thatcher?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 489 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 489 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Not seeing any, so ordered. And then we now, at this point, traditionally, will be appointing a carrier. And it's also our tradition to allow those who have come most recently to the committee to be the carriers of the bills. And so, Senator Lithicum, you are on the short straw on this one. But Senator Manning, I wouldn't laugh too much because I think you'll have yours tomorrow. So if you'd be so kind to carry the bill to the floor, we'd be honored for you to do that.
Thank you.
All right. And so we now have a carrier for the bill. We'll go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 489. And this does, in fact, take care of, I think, most of the stuff we have. I'm going to ask if there's any office stuff we need to take care of. The last thing I do want to make certain the committee understands, we are slotted to meet 4 days a week at this point, Monday through Thursday. What we try to do is adjust our schedule, our start time, based on how much work we think we have. And so please be sure to check every morning or the evening before. What we will be doing, our slot is 8 to 10 or 8 to 9:45, I guess, technically. But we'll be starting most of our meetings at 8:30 to give people a little bit more time to take care of business in their own offices until we start getting into the crunch time. Then we'll start expanding that time. And there is a possibility that if we get down toward the nitty-gritty and we need to have more time, Friday has been traditionally reserved for us as well. I'm not sure if any of the members are full Ways and Means members. Senator Manning is. Okay, so that's going to be something we'll have to work on because full Ways and Means meets on Friday morning normally. And so that's something we'll keep in mind. But hopefully we'll be able to stay on task. And I want to thank you all very much for being here. And until tomorrow at 8:30, we're adjourned. Adjourned.